Alphabaster frowned and looked thoughtfully at his scarred face. "On the other hand," he said slowly, "you always were a crafty dog. And there are a lot of letters there just for a bottle of wine. What about it, sweetheart?" He held the note in front of Maggie again. "Are you going to read it to me now, or should I show it to the magpie?" Maggie snatched the note from him so fast that she had it crumpled behind her back while Buster was still wondering where it had gone. "Give it here, you little brat," he hissed at her. "Give me that note, or I'll cut it out of your fingers." But Maggie retreated from him till her back was up against the grating. "No," she said, clinging to the bars with one hand and pushing the note through them with the other. Dustfinger caught on at once. She felt him taking the paper from her fingers. Buster hit her in the face so hard that her head struck the grating. Immediately her hand stroked her hair, and when she looked around, dazed, she was gazing into her mother's face. "He'll notice any moment," she thought. "He'll understand it all." But Buster had eyes only for Dustfinger, who was waving the note back and forth behind the grating as if he were brandishing a worm in front of a hungry bird's beak.
"Well, how about it?" inquired Dustfinger, taking a step back. "Do you dare come in here with me, or would you rather go on hitting little girls?"
Buster stood there motionless, like a child whose ears have suddenly and unexpectedly been boxed. Then he seized Maggie's arm and dragged her toward him. She felt something cold on her throat. She didn't have to see it to know what it was. Her mother screamed and pulled at Dustfinger's hand, but he only held the note higher in the air.
"I knew it," he said. "What a coward you are, Buster. You'd rather put a knife to a child's throat than venture in here. Of course, if Flatnose were here to back you up, too, with his broad back and his great fat fists. But he isn't. Come along, you're the one with the knife. I've got nothing but my hands, and you know how I hate to misuse them for fighting."
Maggie felt Buster's grip relax. The blade was no longer pressing into her skin. She swallowed and put a hand to her throat. She almost expected to feel warm blood, but there was none. Buster pushed her away so hard that she stumbled and fell on the damp, cold floor. Then he put his hands into his pants pocket and brought out a bunch of keys. He was panting with rage, like a man who had run too far and too fast. Fingers trembling, he put a key into the lock of the cell. Dustfinger watched him, his face impassive. He gestured to Maggie's mother to step back from the grating and retreated himself, nimble as a dancer. You couldn't tell from his scarred face whether he was afraid or not, but the scars looked darker than usual.
"What's that for?" he said when Buster came into the cell and held out his knife. "You might as well put it away. If you kill me, you'll spoil Capricorn's fun. He won't forgive you for that in a hurry."
Yes, he was afraid. Maggie could hear it in his voice. The words were spilling out of his mouth a little too fast.
"Who said anything about killing?"
growled Buster as he closed the cell door behind him. Dustfinger retreated as far as the stone coffin.
"Ah, you were thinking of adding a few more decorations to my face?"
He was almost whispering. There was something else in his voice now. Hatred, scorn, rage.
"Don't expect it to be so easy this time," he said softly. "I've learned a few useful tricks since then." "Have you indeed?"
Buster was standing barely a pace away from him.
"And what may that be? Your friend Fire isn't here to help you. You don't even have that stinking Martin."
"It was words I had in mind." Dustfinger placed a hand on the coffin.
"You see, the fairies have taught me how to lay a curse on someone. They were sorry for my cut face, and they knew how bad I am at fighting. So, I curse you, Buster. I curse you by the bones of the dead man lying in this coffin. I'll bet there's no old priest in it now but someone you disposed of. Isn't that right?"
Buster did not answer, but his silence was more eloquent than any words.
"Of course. An old coffin like this makes a wonderful hiding place.
Dustfinger caressed the cracked lid with his fingers, as if trying to call the dead back to life with the warmth of his hand. "May his spirit haunt you, Buster," he said in a solemn voice. "May he breathe my name in your ear at every step you take. May he..." Meggy saw Buster's hand leap to his rabbit's foot. "That thing won't help you." Dustfinger's hand was still on the coffin. "Poor Buster, are you feeling hot already? Do your limbs begin to tremble?" Buster lunged at him with the knife, but Dustfinger, light on his feet as he was, avoided the blade. "Fire is faster than you, Buster," he whispered, "much faster."
"Give me the note you handed her,"
Buster screamed in his face. Dustfinger just put the note in his pants pocket. Meggy stood motionless as a doll. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw her mother put her hand in the pocket of her dress. When she brought it out again, she was holding a stone in it. A grey stone, not much bigger than a bird's egg. Dustfinger passed his hands over the lid of the coffin, then held them out to Buster. "Shall I touch you?" he asked. "What happens when you touch a murdered man's coffin? Tell me, you know all about such things." He took another step aside, like a dancer circling around his partner.
"I'll cut your filthy fingers off if you try to touch me," yelled Buster, his face red with rage. "Every one of them, and your tongue into the bargain."
He lunged with the knife again, cutting through the air with the bright blade. But Dustfinger avoided it. He was leaping around Buster, faster and faster, ducking, retreating, advancing. But suddenly he found that his fearless dance had trapped him. He had only the bare wall behind him now, and the grating cutting off his retreat to the right, and Buster was coming straight at him. At that moment, Meggy's mother raised her hand. The stone hit Buster on the head. Astonished, he spun around, looked at her as if trying to remember who she was, and put his hand to his bleeding face. She never knew how Dustfinger did it, but suddenly he had Buster's knife in his hand. Buster was staring at his familiar blade in amazement, as if he couldn't grasp the fact that the faithless thing was pointing at his own chest. "Well, how's this, then?" Dustfinger slowly brought the tip of the knife close to Buster's stomach. "Do you feel how soft your flesh is? The human body is a fragile thing, and you can't get a new one. What is it you and your friends do to cats and squirrels? Flatnose likes describing it."
"I don't hunt squirrels,"
Buster's voice cracked. He was trying not to look at the blade now, scarcely a hand's breadth from his snow-white shirt.
"No, so you don't, I remember now. It doesn't amuse you as much as it does the others."
Buster's face was white. All the furious red had ebbed out of it. Fear is not red. Fear is pale as a dead man's face.
"What are you going to do now?"
he gasped. He was breathing hard, as if he were drowning.
"You don't think you'll get out of this village alive, do you? They'll shoot you down before you're across the square."
"Well, I'd prefer that to a meeting with the Shadow," replied Dustfinger. "Anyway, none of you are very good shots."
Meggy's mother came up to him and mimed writing with her finger in the air. Dustfinger put his hand in his pants pocket and gave her the note. Buster followed the paper with his eyes, as if the strength of his gaze would draw it to him. Raisa wrote something on it and handed it back to Dustfinger, who read what she had written, frowning.
"Wait until dark. No, I won't wait.
But perhaps the girl had better stay here."
He looked at Meggy.
"Capricorn won't harm her. After all, she's his new silver tongue, and sometime her father will try to get her."
Dustfinger put the note away again and ran the tip of the knife down Buster's shirt buttons. They clinked as the metal touched them.
"You go to the stairs, Raisa," he said. "I'll finish off this business, and then we'll stroll across Capricorn Square and walk away like an innocent pair of lovers."
Cautiously, Raisa opened the cell door. She came out past the grating and took Meggy's hand. Her fingers were cold and rather rough, a stranger's fingers. But her face was familiar, although it had looked younger and less anxious in the photograph.
Racer, we can't take her with us.
Dustfinger seized Buster's arm and forced him back against the wall.
Her father will murder me if she gets shot out there. Now turn around and cover her eyes, unless you want her to watch.
The knife was trembling in his hand. Racer looked at him, horrified, and shook her head vigorously. But Dustfinger acted as if he didn't see her.
You must thrust hard, dirty fingers,
hissed Buster as he pressed his hands against the stone behind him.
Killing isn't easy. You have to practice to do it well.
Nonsense. Dustfinger grabbed him by the jacket and held the knife under his chin, the way Buster had pulled his knife on Mo that time in the church.
Any fool can kill. It's easy. As easy as throwing a book on the fire, breaking down a door, or frightening a child.
Maggie began to tremble. She didn't know why. Her mother took a step back toward the grating, but when she saw Dustfinger's stony face, she stopped. Then she turned, drew Maggie's face against her breast, put her arms around her, and held her tight. Her smell seemed familiar to Maggie, like something long forgotten. She closed her eyes and tried not to think of anything, not Dustfinger, or the knife, or Buster's white face. And then, for a terrible moment, there was only one thing in the world she wanted. To see Buster lying dead on the floor, limp as a doll thrown away, an ugly, stupid toy that always seemed a little scary. The knife was barely a finger's breadth from Buster's white shirt, but suddenly, Dustfinger plunged his hand into Buster's pants pocket, took out the keys to the cells, and stepped back.
No, you're right. I don't know much about killing, he said as he made his way backward out of the cell, and I'm not about to learn just for you.
A scornful smile spread over Buster's face, but Dustfinger paid no attention. He locked the barred door, took Racer's arm and led her to the stairs.
Let go of her, he begged, when he saw she was still holding Maggie tightly. Believe me, nothing will happen to her, and we can't take her with us.
But Racer just shook her head and put her arm around Maggie's shoulders.
Hey, Dustfinger, called Buster. I knew you couldn't do it. Give me my knife back. You don't know what to do with it anyway.
Dustfinger ignored him.
They'll kill you if you stay, he told Racer.
But he let go of her hand.
Hey, you up there, bellowed Buster. Help! Help! The prisoners are escaping!
Maggie looked at Dustfinger in alarm. Why didn't you gag him?
What with, princess?
Asked Dustfinger. Racer held Maggie close and stroked her hair.
They'll shoot you! They'll shoot you!
Buster's voice rang out.
Hey there! Help!
He shouted again, shaking the bars of the grating. Footsteps were heard overhead. Dustfinger swore quietly, cast Racer one last glance, then turned and ran up the worn steps. Maggie couldn't hear whether or not he'd got the door open at the top. She could hear nothing but Buster's shouting, and she ran back toward him, helpless but wanting to strike him through the bars right in his bellowing face. Once again she heard footsteps overhead, muffled cries. What were they to do? Someone came crashing down the stairs. Was Dustfinger coming back? No, it wasn't his face, but flat noses that emerged from the darkness. Another of Capricorn's men was stumbling down the stairs behind him. He looked very young, round-faced and beardless, but he immediately pointed his gun at Maggie and her mother.
"Hello there, bastard! What are you doing behind those bars?" asked Flatnose, surprised. "Open up, you damn fool!" snapped Buster through the grating. "Dustfinger's gone!" "Dustfinger?"
Flatnose wiped his face on his sleeve.
"Then the lad here was right. Came to me just now and said he'd seen the fire eater up there behind a column. And you didn't give chase? Are you really as big a fool as you look?"
Buster pressed his face to the bars as if he could make his way through them.
Hey, watch what you say, okay?
Flatnose came up to the grating and studied Buster with obvious pleasure.
So that dirty-fingered fellow has outwitted you again. Capricorn won't like that.
Send someone after him, roared Buster, or I'll tell Capricorn it was you who let him go.
Flatnose took a handkerchief out of his pants pocket and noisily blew his nose.
Oh, yes? So who's behind bars, you or me? He won't get far. There are two guards in the parking area, another three in the square, and his face is easy to recognize. You may be good and sure of that, right?
His laughter sounded like a dog barking.
Tell you what, I could really get used to this sight. Your face looks good behind bars.
They're just the thing to stop you from waving your knife around under anyone's nose. Will you unlock this damn door? Bellowed Buster, or I'll cut off your ugly nose. Open up!
Flatnose folded his arms.
Sadly, I can't.
He smirked in a mock-serious voice.
Our dirty-fingered friend seems to have taken the keys. Or do you see them anywhere?
He inquired of the boy who was still pointing his gun at Maggie and her mother. When he shook his head, Flatnose grinned all over his squashed-in face.
No, we can't see them either. Well, I suppose I'll just have to go to Mortula. Maybe she has a master key.
"Wipe that grin off your face," shouted Buster, "or I'll carve it off."
"You don't say. I can't see your knife anywhere. Has Dustfinger stolen another one? If this goes on, he'll soon have a whole collection."
Flatnose turned his back on Buster and pointed to the cell next to him.
"Shut the woman in there and guard her till I get back with the keys," he said. "I'll just take little Miss Silvertongue back to her room first."
Maggie resisted as he pulled her away, but Flatnose simply picked her up and threw her over his shoulder.
"What was the girl doing down here anyway?" he asked. "Does Capricorn know about it?"
"Ask the magpie," spat Buster.
"No fear,"
Flatnose muttered as he marched toward the stairs with Maggie. She had time to see the boy push her mother into the other cell with the barrel of his gun. Then she saw only the steps and the door of the church and the dusty square as Flatnose carried her across it like a sack of potatoes.
"Let's hope your voice isn't as thin as you,"
he grunted as he put her down on her feet outside the room,
"or the shadow will be rather narrow-chested if he really does turn up this evening."
Maggie did not answer. When Flatnose unlocked the door, she walked past Fenolio without a word, climbed up on her bed, and buried her head in Moe's sweater. Chapter 50. No Luck for Eleanor. Eleanor had been driving for more than an hour before she finally reached a town with its own police station. The sea was still some way off, but the hills were lower, and vines grew on the slopes rather than the undergrowth and trees that grew on the hills around Capricorn's village. It was terribly hot, even hotter than the day before, and when Eleanor got out of the car, she heard a distant rumble of thunder that sounded as if a great beast were lurking somewhere beyond the hills. The sky above the houses was a blue as dark as deep water, an ominous blue.
"Don't be silly, Eleanor," she told herself as she made for the pale yellow building that was the police station. "There's a storm coming, that's all. Not getting as superstitious as that man Buster, are you?"
There were two officers in the small police station. They had hung their uniform jackets over their chairs. Despite the big fan whirring around under the ceiling, the air was so muggy it could have been bottled. The younger of the two men, who was broad and snub-nosed like a pug-dog, laughed at Eleanor when she told her story, and asked whether she looked so red in the face, perhaps, because she liked the local wine a little too much. Eleanor would have tipped him off his chair if his companion hadn't calmed her down. The second officer was a tall, thin man with a melancholy expression, and dark hair thinning above his forehead.
"Stop that," he told the other policeman. "At least let her finish her story."
He listened unmoved as Eleanor told them about Capricorn's village and the black jackets, frowned when she started talking about fire-raising and dead roosters, and when she came to Maggie and the planned execution, he raised his eyebrows. She said nothing, of course, about the book and just how the execution was to be carried out. Only 2 weeks ago, she wouldn't have believed a word of it herself. When she had finished, the tall man said nothing for a while. He rearranged the pencils on his desk, tidied some papers, and finally looked at her thoughtfully.
"I've heard about that village before," he said. "Naturally, everyone's heard of it," mocked the other officer. "The devil's village, the accursed village, even the snakes avoid it. The walls of the church are painted with blood, and black jackets, who are really ghosts and carry fire in their pockets, haunt the streets. You only have to get near them and you go up in smoke. Whoosh!"
He raised his hands and clapped them above his head. Eleanor looked at him icily. His colleague smiled, but then rose with a sigh, laboriously put on his jacket, and signed to Eleanor to follow him.
"I'm going to take a look at this," he said over his shoulder. "Might as well, if you've nothing better to do," the other man called after him, laughing so uproariously that Eleanor felt like going back to tip him off his chair after all.
A little later, she was in the passenger seat of a police car, and the road along which she had come was winding its way through the hills. "Why on earth," she kept thinking, "didn't I do this before? Everything will be all right now, everything. No one will be shot or executed. Maggie will get her father back, and Mortimer will be reunited with his daughter. Yes, everything will be all right, thanks to Eleanor." She could have sung and danced, not that she was much of a dancer, and she was sitting in a car. She had never in her life felt so pleased with herself. Now who could say she didn't know how to cope with the real world? The policeman beside her said nothing. He just kept his eyes on the road, taking bend after bend at a speed that made Eleanor's heart beat painfully fast. Occasionally he absent-mindedly kneaded his right earlobe. He seemed to know the way and never hesitated when the road branched or passed any turning. Eleanor could not help thinking how long it had taken her and Mo to search for the village. Suddenly, a disturbing thought came into her mind.
"There are quite a lot of them," she said in an uncertain voice, just as they were taking another bend so fast they came alarmingly close to the abyss yawning on her left. "I mean, this Capricorn has a lot of men, and they're armed, even if they're not particularly good shots. Might it be a good idea to ask for reinforcements?"
That was what people did in stupid films about cops and robbers. The police were always asking for reinforcements. The policeman with her ran his hand through his sparse hair and nodded as if he had already thought of that.
"Yes, of course," he said, reaching for his radio. "Reinforcements won't hurt, but they'd better keep in the background. The first thing is to ask a few questions."
Over the radio, he asked for 5 men. Not many against Capricorn's black jackets, thought Eleanor, but better than nothing, certainly better than a desperate father, an Arab boy, and an overweight book collector.
"There it is,"
she said as Capricorn's village appeared in the distance, grey and insignificant-looking amidst all the dark green.
"Yes, that's what I thought," replied the policeman,
after which he was silent again. When he just nodded to the guard in the parking lot, Eleanor simply refused to believe the worst. Only when they were standing in front of Capricorn, and he was handing her over like lost property being restored to its rightful owner, was she forced to admit to herself that nothing was going to turn out well after all. Everything was ruined now, and oh, how stupid she had been, how dreadfully stupid.
"She's spreading slander about you,"
he heard the policeman tell Capricorn, avoiding Eleanor's eyes.
"Something about child abduction, and there was talk of fire-raising."
"All nonsense," replied Capricorn, answering the unspoken question in a bored voice. "I love children, as long as they don't come too close to me."
Children and business don't mix. The policeman nodded and looked unhappily at his hands, and she said something about an execution.
Did she indeed?
Capricorn looked Eleanor up and down as if amazed by such fantasies.
Well, as you know, I have no call for anything of that nature. People do as I say without my having to resort to such drastic measures.
Of course, murmured the policeman, nodding. Of course.
He couldn't wait to leave. As his rapid, clipped footsteps died away, Cockerell, who had been sitting on the steps, laughed.
He has three small children, right? It ought to be compulsory for all policemen to have small children. That one was a pushover. Buster just had to stand outside the school twice. What about it? Should we pay him another visit to refresh his memory?
Capricorn shook his head.
I don't think that will be necessary. Let's just think about what to do with our guest here. How should we deal with someone who tells such shocking lies about us?
Eleanor felt weak at the knees as he turned his colourless eyes on her. If Mortimer offered to read me into some book now, any book, she thought, I'd accept. I wouldn't even want to pick and choose. Three or four black-clad men were standing behind her, so trying to run away was pointless.
All you can do is submit to your fate with dignity, Eleanor, she told herself.
But reading about such a thing was much easier than doing it.
The crypt or the sheds?
Asked Cockerell, strolling up to her.
The crypt, thought Eleanor. Dustfinger said something about that, and it was nothing nice.
The crypt? Why not? We have to dispose of her, or who might she bring here next?
Capricorn hid a yawn behind his hand.
Very well. We'll give the shadow a little more work to do this evening. He'll like that.
Eleanor wanted to say something, something bold and heroic, but her tongue wouldn't work. It just lay there in her mouth, numb. Cockerell had already hauled her as far as that ridiculous statue when Capricorn called him back.
I quite forgot to ask her about Silver Tongue, he cried. Ask her if she happens to know where he is at the moment. Well, come on, out with it, growled Cockerell, seizing her by the nape of the neck as if to shake the answer out of her. Where is he?
Eleanor tightened her lips.
Quick, Eleanor, quick, she told herself. Think of a good answer. And suddenly, her tongue was working again.
Why ask me?
She said to Capricorn, who was still sitting in his chair, as pale as if he had been left in the wash too long, or the sun burning down out in the square had bleached him.
You should know. He's dead. Your men shot him, and the boy.
Look at him, Eleanor, she thought. Look him straight in the face the way you used to look at your father when he caught you with the wrong book. A few tears would come in useful, too. Go on. Just think of your books, all your burnt books. Think of last night, the fear, the despair. And if none of that works, pinch yourself.
Capricorn was gazing at her thoughtfully.
There, Cockerell called to him. I knew we'd hit him.
Eleanor was still looking at Capricorn, a blurred sight through the veil of her false tears.
We'll see, he said slowly. My men are searching the hills for an escaped prisoner. I don't suppose you're going to tell me where they should look for the two bodies.
I buried them, and I'm certainly not saying where.
Eleanor felt a tear running down her nose. By all the letters of the alphabet, Eleanor, she told herself, there's a great actress lost in you.
Buried them. Well, well.
Capricorn played with the rings on his left hand. He was wearing three at once, and he adjusted them, frowning as if they had gotten out of line without his permission.
That's why I went to the police, said Eleanor, to avenge them and my books.
Cockerell laughed.
You didn't have to bury those books, right? They burn beautifully, like the very best firewood, and their pages, they quivered like pale little fingers.
He raised his hands and imitated the movement. Eleanor hit him in the face with all her might, and she was quite strong. Blood flowed from Cockerell's nose. He wiped it away with his hand and looked at it as if he was surprised to see something so red coming out of him.
"Look at that,"
he said, showing Capricorn his blood-stained fingers.
"You wait, she'll give the shadow more trouble than Basta."
When he led her away, Eleanor walked beside him with her head held high. Only when she saw the steep stairway disappearing into a bottomless black hole did her courage forsake her for a moment. The crypt, of course, now she remembered, the place where they put the condemned. That was what it smelled like anyway, damp and mouldy, just as one imagines the odour of death. At first, Eleanor couldn't believe her eyes when she saw Basta's wiry figure pressed up against the iron bars. She had thought she must have misheard Cockerell's last remark, but sure enough, there was Basta, shut up in the cage like an animal, with all the fear and hopelessness of a trapped beast in his eyes. Even the sight of Eleanor did not cheer him. He looked straight through her and Cockerell as if they were two of the ghosts he feared so much.
"What's he doing here?" asked Eleanor. "Have you taken to locking each other up now?"
Cockerell shrugged.
"Should I tell her?"
he asked Basta, who responded with nothing but the same glazed stare.
"First he let Silvertongue escape, and now Dustfinger. That's a sure way to ruin your chances with the boss, even if you do think you're his personal pet. And of course it's been years since you managed to light a decent fire."
He smiled maliciously at Basta.
"Signora Loredan, it's time to think about making a will," Eleanor told herself as Cockerell pushed her into the crypt. "If Capricorn intends to kill his most faithful dog, he's certainly not going to stop short at you."
"Hey, you might look a bit more cheerful," Cockerell told Basta as he fished a bunch of keys out of his jacket pocket. "You've got two women for company now."
Basta pressed his forehead against the grating.
"Haven't you caught the Fire Eater yet?" he croaked.
His voice sounded as if he had shouted himself hoarse.
"No, but the fat woman here says we hit Silvertongue. Says he's dead as a doornail. Sounds like I winged him after all. Well, I have had plenty of practice on the cats."
Behind the door with the grating that Cockerell unlocked for her, something moved. A woman was sitting there in the dark, leaning back against something that looked suspiciously like a stone coffin. Eleanor could not see the woman's face, but then the figure straightened up.
"Company for you, Racer,"
called Cockerell as he pushed Eleanor through the open door.
"You two can have a nice chat."
He was laughing uproariously as he trudged away. As for Eleanor, she didn't know whether to laugh or cry. She would rather have seen her favourite niece again anywhere but here.
Chapter 51 A Narrow Escape. Farid heard footsteps just as they were making the torches. The torches had to be larger and more solid than those Dustfinger used in his shows, for they would have to burn a long time. Farid had already cut Silvertongue's hair with the knife Dustfinger had given him. It was short and bristly now, and at least that made Silvertongue look slightly different. Farid had also shown him the kind of earth he needed to rub on his face to darken his skin. No one must recognize them, not this time. But then he heard footsteps. And voices. One was speaking angrily, the other laughed and called out, but they were still too far away for him to make out the words. Silvertongue picked up the torches, and Gwyn snapped at Farid's fingers as the boy pushed him roughly into the backpack. "Where can we hide, Farid? Where?" whispered Silvertongue.
"I know a place."
Farid threw the backpack over his shoulder and led Silvertongue over to the charred wall. He climbed over the blackened stones where there had once been a window, jumped down in the dry grass behind the wall, and crouched low. The metal cover he now pushed aside had buckled in the fire and was overgrown by alyssum. Its tiny white flowers rambled like snow over the opening. Farid had found the metal plate while he was exploring during the long hours he spent here,
with the silent and ever-reserved Dustfinger. He had jumped off the wall and noticed the hollow sound. Perhaps the space under it had originally been a store for perishable foodstuffs, but at least once before, it had also been used as a hiding place. Silvertongue recoiled when he touched the skeleton in the darkness. It looked small, scarcely big enough for an adult, and it lay there in the cramped underground space, quite peacefully, curled up as if it had lain down to sleep. Perhaps it was because it looked so peaceful that Farid was not afraid of it. If there was a ghost down here, he felt sure it could only be a sad, pale creature, nothing to be frightened of. There wasn't much space when Farid drew the metal cover across again. Silvertongue was tall, almost too tall to hide here. But it was reassuring to have him close, even if his heart was beating just as fast as Farid's own. The boy could feel every single beat as they crouched there side by side, listening for sounds from above. The voices were coming closer, but it was difficult to make them out, for the ground muffled them as if they came from another world. Once a foot stepped on the metal cover, and Farid dug his fingers into Silvertongue's arm and wouldn't let him go until all was quiet again overhead. It was a long time before they dared trust the silence, such a very long time that once or twice Farid turned his head because he imagined that the skeleton had moved. When Silvertongue cautiously raised the metal cover and looked out, it did seem as if they really had gone. Only the grasshoppers were chirping tirelessly, and a bird, startled, flew up from the charred wall. Whoever it was had taken everything with them. The blankets, the sweater that Farid had curled up in at night like a snail going into its shell, even the blood-stained bandages that Silvertongue had tied around the boy's forehead the night they'd been shot at. "Never mind," said Silvertongue, as they stood beside their cold fireplace. "We won't be needing our blankets tonight." Then he ran his fingers through Farid's dark hair. "What would I do without you? Master scout? Rabbit catcher? Finder of hiding places?" he asked. Farid stared at his bare toes and smiled. Chapter 52. A Fragile Little Thing. Capricorn's men were looking for Dustfinger in the wrong place. He hadn't left the village. He hadn't even tried. Dustfinger was in Basta's house. It was in an alley just behind Capricorn's yard, surrounded by empty houses inhabited only by cats and rats. Basta did not want neighbors. Indeed, he wanted no other company but Capricorn's. Dustfinger knew Basta would have slept on the threshold of Capricorn's room if he'd been allowed to. But none of the men lived in the main house. They stood guard there, that was all. They ate in the church and slept in one or other of the many abandoned houses in the village. That was the rule, and it could not be broken. Most of the men kept moving around, living in one house and going on to another when the roof began to leak. Only Basta had lived in the same place ever since they came to the village. Dustfinger suspected he had chosen that house because St. John's wort grew beside the door, and there is no other plant with such a reputation for keeping away evil, leaving aside the evil in Basta's own heart. Like most of the buildings in the village, the house was built of grey stone with black painted shutters that Basta usually kept closed, and on which he had painted the signs he believed would keep bad luck away, just like the yellow flowers of St. John's wort. Sometimes Dustfinger thought Basta's constant fear of curses and sudden disaster probably arose from his terror of the darkness within himself, which made him assume that the rest of the world must be exactly the same. Dustfinger had been lucky to make it as far as Basta's house. He had run into a whole crowd of Capricorn's men almost as soon as he stumbled out of the church. Of course, they had recognized him instantly. Basta had long ago made that a certainty. But their surprise had given Dustfinger just enough time to disappear down one of the alleys. Fortunately, he knew every nook and cranny of this accursed village. He had meant to make for the parking area and go on into the hills, but then he thought of Basta's empty house. He had forced his way through holes in walls, crawled through cellars, and ducked down behind the parapets of balconies that were no longer used. When it came to hiding, even Gwyn had nothing to teach Dustfinger. A strange sense of curiosity had always driven him to explore the hidden, forgotten corners of this and any other place, and all that knowledge had now come in useful. He was out of breath when he finally reached Basta's house. Basta was probably the only man in Capricorn's village who locked his front door, but the lock was no great obstacle to Dustfinger. He let himself in and hid in the attic until his heart had slowed down. Even though the wooden planks were so rotten, he feared he would go through the floor at every step. Downstairs, he found enough food in Basta's kitchen to quell the hunger that had been gnawing like a worm at the walls of his stomach. Neither he nor Racer had been given anything to eat since they were put in those nets, so it was doubly satisfying to fill his belly with Basta's food. When he had partially satisfied his hunger, he opened one of the shutters, just a crack, so he could have warning in good time of any approaching footsteps. But the only sound that met his ears was a tinkling, so faint he could hardly hear it. Only then did he remember the fairy that Maggie had read into this world that normally had no fairies. He found her in Basta's bedroom. The room contained nothing but a bed and a chest of drawers on which a number of bricks lay, carefully arranged side by side, all of them covered with soot. They said in the village that whenever Capricorn had a house set on fire, Basta took away a brick or stone, even though he feared fire at other times, and clearly that story was true. On one of the bricks stood a glass jug, with a faint light coming from it, not much brighter than a glowworm would have made. The fairy was lying at the bottom of the glass, crumpled up like a butterfly just out of the cocoon. Basta had put a plate over the top of the jug, but the fragile little thing didn't look as if she had the strength to fly. When Dustfinger took the plate away, the fairy didn't even raise her head. Dustfinger put his hand into her glass prison and carefully took the little creature out. Her limbs were so delicate he was afraid his fingers would break them. The fairies, he knew, had looked different, smaller but stronger, with fair blue skin and four shimmering wings. This one had skin the same colour as a human, a very pale human, and her wings were more like butterfly than dragonfly wings. But would she like the same things to eat as the fairies he knew? It was worth a try. She looked half dead. Dustfinger took the pillow off Basta's bed and put it on the kitchen table, which was scrubbed clean. Everything in Basta's house was scrubbed clean, as spotless as his snow-white shirt. He laid the fairy on the pillow, then filled a dish with milk and put it on the table beside her. She immediately opened her eyes. So, in having a good sense of smell and a taste for milk, she seemed no different from the fairies he knew. He dipped his finger in the milk and let a white drop fall on her lips. She licked it up like a hungry little cat. Dustfinger trickled drop after drop into her mouth until she sat up and feebly beat her wings. Her face had a little colour in it now, but although he spoke three fairy languages, he understood not a word of what she finally said in her faint, tinkling voice. "What a pity," he whispered as she spread her wings and flew, rather unsteadily, up to the ceiling. "That means I can't ask you if you could make me invisible, or so small that you could carry me to Capricorn's festivities." The fairy looked down at him, tinkled something that he couldn't understand, and settled on the side of the kitchen cupboard. Dustfinger sat down on the only chair by Basta's kitchen table and looked up at her. "All the same," he said, "it's good to see someone like you again. If only the fire in this world had more of a sense of humour, and a troll or a glass man would look out of the trees now and then. Well, perhaps I could get used to the rest of it after all, the noise, the speed, the crowds, and the way the nights are so much lighter." He sat there in his worst enemy's kitchen for quite a long time, watching the fairy flying around the room investigating everything, for fairies are naturally inquisitive, and this one was obviously no exception. Every now and then she stopped to sip her milk, and he filled the dish a second time. Once or twice footsteps approached, but each time they passed by the house. What a good thing Buster had no friends. The air that came in through the window was sultry. It made Dustfinger drowsy. The narrow strip of sky showing above the houses would stay light for many hours yet, long enough for him to make up his mind whether or not to go to Capricorn's festivities. Why should he go? He could get hold of the book later, sometime when all the excitement in the village had died down and everything was back to normal. And what about Rasa? What was going to happen to her? The shadow would come for her. There was nothing to be done about that, not by anyone, not even Silvertongue, if he was really so crazy as to try. But Silvertongue didn't know about her, or about his daughter. At least there was no need to worry about Meggie, not now that she was Capricorn's favourite toy. Capricorn wouldn't let the shadow hurt her. "No, I won't go," thought Dustfinger. "I'll hide here for a while. Tomorrow there'll be no more Buster, that's one good thing. And perhaps I will go away from here, go away forever." No, he knew he wouldn't do that. Not while the book was here. The fairy had flown over to the window and was peering curiously out at the alley. "Forget it. Stay here," said Dustfinger. "Please, believe me. It's no place for you out there." She looked at him quizzically, then folded her wings and knelt on the windowsill. And there she stayed, as if she couldn't decide between the hot room and the strange freedom to be found outside. Chapter 53 The Right Words. Fenolio wrote and wrote, but the number of pages he had hidden under the mattress was no greater. He kept taking them out, fiddling with them, tearing up one and adding another. "No, no, no," Meggie heard him muttering crossly to himself. "No, that's not it yet." "It will be dark in a few hours," she said at last anxiously. "Suppose you don't finish it in time."
"I have finished," he snapped, irritated. "I've finished a dozen times already, but I'm not happy with it."
He lowered his voice to a whisper before he went on.
"There are so many questions. Suppose the shadow turns on you or me or the prisoners once he's killed Capricorn, and is killing Capricorn really the only solution? What's going to happen to his men afterward? What do I do with them?"
"What do you think? The shadow must kill them all," Meggie whispered back. "How else are we ever going to get home or rescue my mother?"
Fenolio did not like this reply.
"Good heavens, what a heartless creature you are," he whispered. "Kill them all? Haven't you seen how young some of them are?"
He shook his head.
"No, I'm not a mass murderer. I'm a writer. I'm sure I can think of some less bloodthirsty ending."
And he began writing again, and crossing out words, and writing more, while outside the sun sank lower and lower until its rays were gilding the hilltops. Every time steps came along the corridor, Fenolio hid what he had been writing under his mattress. But no one came in to see what the old man kept scribbling on his blank sheets of paper. For Buster was down in the crypt. The bored guards on duty outside their door had several visitors that afternoon. Men had obviously come into the village from Capricorn's outposts to watch the execution. Putting her ear to the door, Meggie eavesdropped on their conversations. They laughed a lot, and their voices sounded excited. They were all looking forward to the night's spectacle. Not one of them seemed to feel sorry for Buster, far from it. Knowing Capricorn's former favourite was to die that night just seemed to add to their fun. Of course, they discussed Meggie, too, that little witch, they called her, that little madam, the enchantress, and not all of them seemed to be convinced of her powers. As for Buster's executioner, Meggie learned no more than what Fenolio had already told her and what she remembered of the passage the magpie had made her read. It wasn't much, but she heard the fear in those voices outside the door, and the horrified awe that overcame them all at the mention of his name, which was not a real name at all. Only those who, like Capricorn himself, had come out of Fenolio's book had ever seen the shadow, but they had all obviously heard about him, and they painted pictures in the darkest tones of how he would deal with the prisoners. There were evidently several opinions about how he actually killed his victims, but the suggestions Meggie overheard grew more and more horrible the closer evening came, until she could bear it no longer. She went to sit by the window with her hands over her ears. It was 6 o'clock. The church clock was just beginning to strike when Fenolio suddenly put down his pen and looked over what he had written with a satisfied expression. "Got it," he whispered. "Yes, that's it. That's how it will be. It will turn out splendidly." Impatiently, he beckoned Meggie over and gave her the paper. "Read it," he whispered, glancing nervously at the door. Out in the corridor, Flatnose was just boasting of the way he had poisoned the farmer's stocks of olive oil. "Is that all?" Meggie looked incredulously at the single sheet of paper. "Yes, that's all. No more is needed. As you'll see, the words just have to be the right ones. Go on, read it." Meggie did as he said. The men outside were laughing, and she found it difficult to concentrate on Fenolio's words. Finally, she did it. But she'd no sooner finished the first sentence when the men outside fell utterly silent. The magpie's voice echoed down the corridor. "What's all this? A coffee break?" Fenolio hastily took the precious paper and put it under his mattress. He was just readjusting the bedspread when the magpie opened the door. "Your supper," she told Meggie, putting a steaming plate down on the table. "What about me?" inquired Fenolio in a deliberately cheerful voice. The mattress had slipped slightly when he hid the paper under it, and he had to lean against his bed to hide it from Mortala, but luckily she had no eyes for him. Meggie felt sure she thought he was merely a liar, and very likely it annoyed her that Capricorn did not agree with her. "Eat it all up," she ordered Meggie, "and then get changed. Your clothes look dreadful and stiff with dirt, too." She signalled to the maid who had come with her, a young girl at most only 4 or 5 years older than Meggie herself. The rumours of Meggie's supposed powers of witchcraft had obviously reached this girl's ears, too. A snow-white dress was draped over her arm, and she avoided looking at Meggie as she made her way past her to hang it in the closet. "I don't want that dress," Meggie spat at the magpie. "I want to wear this." She took Moe's sweater off her bed, but Mortala snatched it from her hands. "Nonsense! Do you want Capricorn to think we've been keeping you in a sack? You'll wear that dress. Either you put it on yourself, or we'll put it on you. I will come for you as soon as darkness falls. Wash your face and comb your hair. You look like a stray cat." The maid scurried past Meggie again, looking frightened as if any contact might burn her. The magpie impatiently pushed the girl out into the corridor. "Lock the door," she told Flatnose, "and send your friends away. You're supposed to be on guard." Flatnose strolled casually toward the door. Meggie saw him make a face at the magpie behind her back before he closed it. She went over to the dress and touched the white material. "White," she murmured. "I don't like white things. Death has white hounds. Mo once told me a story about them."
"Ah, yes, the white, red-eyed hounds of death."
Fenolio came over to her.
"Ghosts are white, too, and the thirst of the ancient gods for blood was quenched only by white sacrificial animals, as if the gods liked the taste of innocence best." "Oh, no, no," he added quickly, seeing Meggie's terrified eyes. "No, believe me, Capricorn certainly wasn't thinking of any such thing when he sent you that dress. How would he know such stories? White is the colour of the beginning, too, and of the end. And both of us," he added, lowering his voice, "remember, you and I, Meggie, are going to make sure it is Capricorn's end, and not ours." Gently he led Maggie to the table and made her sit down. The smell of roast meat rose to her nostrils. "What do you think it is?" she asked.
"Looks like veal. Why?"
Maggie pushed the plate away.
"I'm not hungry," she murmured.
Fenolio looked at her with great sympathy.
"You know, Maggie," he said, "I think I should write a story about you next. You, and how you save us all with your voice. It would be a very exciting story."
"But would it have a happy ending?" Maggie looked out of the window. Only another hour, two at the most, and it would be dark. Suppose Mo came then. Suppose he made another attempt to free her. He didn't know what she and Fenolio were planning. Suppose they shot at him again. Suppose they really did hit him last time. Maggie put her arms on the table and buried her face in them. She felt Fenolio stroking her hair.
"It will be all right, Maggie," he whispered. "Believe me, my stories always have happy endings, if I want them to."
"That dress has very tight sleeves," she whispered. "How will I hide the paper in my sleeve without the magpie noticing?"
"I'll distract her attention, don't worry."
"But later, they'll all see me take the paper out."
"Nonsense, you'll manage."
Fenolio put a hand under her chin. "It will be all right, Maggie," he said again, wiping a tear off her cheek with his forefinger.
"You're not alone, even if you may feel so tonight. I'm here, and Dustfinger is somewhere out there. I know him as well as I know myself, and I can assure you he'll come, if only to see the book, and perhaps get it back. And then there's your father, and that boy who was looking at you in such a lovesick way back in the square in front of the memorial when I first saw Dustfinger."
"Oh, stop it." Maggie dug her elbow into his stomach, but she had to laugh, even though her tears were still blurring everything, the table, her hands, Fenolio's wrinkled face. She felt as if she had used up enough tears for a whole lifetime in these last few weeks.
"Why, he's a good-looking lad. I'd put in a good word for him with your father like a shot."
"I said stop it."
"Only if you'll eat something."
Fenolio pushed the plate back toward her.
"And that lady, your friend, what was her name?"
"Eleanor."
Maggie put an olive in her mouth and chewed it until she could feel the stone between her teeth.
"Exactly. Perhaps she's out there, too, with your father. Good Lord, when I come to think of it, we're almost in the majority."
Maggie almost choked on the olive stone. Fenolio smiled, pleased with himself. Mo always raised his eyebrows when he had managed to make her laugh, looking both surprised and serious, as if he had no idea what she was laughing at. Maggie could see his face before her so clearly that she might almost have reached out to touch it.
"You'll soon see your father again," whispered Fenolio. "And then you can tell him that you found your mother along the way and rescued her from Capricorn. That's quite something, don't you think?"
Maggie just nodded. The dress felt scratchy on her throat and arms. It was more like a dress for a grown-up than a child, and it was somewhat too big for Maggie. When she took a few steps in it, she trod on the hem. The sleeves fitted tightly, but she had no difficulty in pushing the sheet of paper up inside one of them. It was as thin as a dragonfly's leg. She practiced a couple of times, pushing it in, pulling it out. Finally, she lifted up her sleeve. It crackled slightly when she moved her hands or raised that arm. The moon hung pale in the sky above the church tower, and the night wore a veil of moonlight when the magpie came back to fetch Maggie.
"You haven't combed your hair," she said crossly.
This time she had another maid with her, a stocky woman with a red face and red hands who was obviously not afraid of Maggie's powers of witchcraft. She pulled the comb so brutally through Maggie's hair that she almost cried out.
"Shoes!"
said the magpie, seeing Maggie's bare toes peep out from under the hem of the dress.
"Didn't anyone think of shoes?"
"She could put those on,"
the maid pointed to Maggie's worn-out sneakers.
The dress is long enough. No one will see them. Anyway, don't witches always go barefoot?
The magpie gave her such a look that her voice died on her lips.
Exactly, cried Fenolio, who had been watching the two women get